Life's a mystery, right? What makes life possible? Social anthropologist Marilyn Schlitz, who is enjoying a groundbreaking career crossing over from researcher to scientist to senior fellow at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, is proposing Death Makes Life Possible. This, the title of her recent film and soon-to-be-released book, offers an opening through research, conversation, and heart to live a fuller life. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Congratulations are due for your award-winning film, Death Makes Life Possible. So congratulations, Marilyn.
Thank you. It's been a great ride.
Is it worth comparing writing a book to making a movie?
I found it very different. I think there's more opportunity to be directive in a book than it is in a film. In a film, you have to, you know, respond to the quality of whatever the footage was that you collected. And it's kind of like a giant jigsaw puzzle and trying to get the pieces to go together in a coherent storyline with an arc. And but they're both really fun, and I'd love to do both again.
All right. Your work seems to always include extended human capabilities. That's just such a fascinating topic. And this certainly fits into it, experiencing and remembering the near-death experience. What have you gleaned from this research? And perhaps you can share one or two of the more outrageous experiences you've been privy to.
Wow. So I think that we all have these capacities within us that are beyond the strictly physical, material aspects of our existence. And they often are in contradiction to what the dominant culture anticipates or gives us reason to believe is possible. So things like telepathy are reported over and over again, and yet mainstream science doesn't really acknowledge it. Or precognition, an ability to have an insight about the future and then discover that something that you dreamed, for example, came true. These are things that have been recorded throughout history. Every culture has, you know, people who've had these kinds of experiences. According to Gallup poll, you know, a majority of people have had them, and yet they continue to be considered sort of heretical in the mind of mainstream materialist science. And so I've been interested in that. I've been interested in trying to understand what are the extended reaches of our human potential and how can we utilize them in order to live bigger, fuller, juicier lives. So in terms of making this film, we were really looking at people's experiences of consciousness that suggests it's beyond the brain. And so people having a near-death experience, for example, and seeing themselves, you know, from a different vantage point, even though the body may be unconscious. And that's very striking evidence that there's something else going on, or, you know, these out-of-body experiences, incidents of reincarnation, somebody remembering a past life. All of these things are, you know, very well documented at this point and yet not understood. So in my own experience, I had, I've had a number of experiences that suggest to me that there's something else going on. One was when I was about 16 and was in a very serious motorcycle accident. We were driving and a drunk driver had pulled out without his lights on and hit us. And I distinctly remember, even to this day, watching my body tumbling through the air. So watching, implying that my observation point was somewhere different than the physical body that was, you know, ultimately crashing to the ground. And I ended up with 66 stitches in my leg. People were very concerned that I was going to have an amputation. But the out-of-body experience gave me sort of an insight that there are these powers and potentials within us and within me, and that maybe our consciousness is something more than, you know, what they call an epiphenomenon or a byproduct of the brain. I then, you know, went home. They'd put a cast on my legs from my hip to my ankle, And, you know, there was concern that I would lose my leg. And so I remember having this insight. There was kind of this deep intuition that said if I could harness my imagination, I could help motivate my immune system to heal my leg. And so I did that, and I have no idea where that idea came from. I didn't come from a medical family. You know, maybe I'd seen something on television. I don't know, really. But I do remember feeling the tingles going up my leg, and ultimately a week later they took the cast off. And, you know, it wasn't a miraculous recovery, and I still have a very gnarly scar on my leg, but I healed. And so that was kind of a second instance in my mind of this idea that consciousness has powers that we can utilize to help make us happier and healthier.
Absolutely. And I noticed a quote from Judith Orloff about how, about one of your books, and she says how medicine can and must be expanded to integrate mind, body, and soul. And my thought about it was to say that's putting the cart before the horse. And what about expanding perception and integration of the mind, body, and soul first? And then the medicine won't even matter. And that's exactly what you were just speaking about. It sounds
like... Well, I think we go together. You know, I mean, I think that if someone is sick or facing some kind of health challenge, you want to bring all the potentials together. And yet we know that healing is more than curing. You know, you can cure or not, but healing is really about that restoration of wholeness, that feeling that there is a seamlessness between, you know, my right action, my sense of connectedness to my family, to my community, to the world. That's really the deeper healing. And, you know, people may heal in the course of death, and that's a beautiful thing to witness.
Yes, that's a wonderful thing. I did some work with Dr. John R. Christopher, who is an amazing healer, using mostly herbs and iridology, etc. And that was his point. He said sometimes even people were too sick to die. They needed to have come to a certain healing before they could let go.
That's a beautiful insight.
Yeah. Did you study many cultures and their approach to death and their beliefs for the afterlife? And is there any one culture you think got it down?
Well, I'm an anthropologist by training.
Yes.
And my career has been in search of amazing encounters with people from my own culture, from many different cultures. I've traveled all over the world and had the chance to work with, you know, indigenous people in the Amazon, or, you know, I stayed last year in a monastery in Taiwan with a group of Tibetan nuns. Fantastic experience. Later last year, I was with a group of Muslims in West Virginia, involved in prayer and practice, as well as scholarly pursuits. So I have a deep commitment to engaging people who have different worldviews, different cultures, in order to really understand the threads that connect us. And, you know, the big common denominator for all traditions, for all people, for all times, is death and our own mortality. And so I think to the extent people can overcome their fear of death and then transform that into an inspiration for living, then we can begin to see our shared experiences. And I am, you know, really concerned, as many of us are, about the kind of ethnic violence that's going on at a global scale right now. And I really do believe that there is this kind of death awareness that if people can come to in a way that isn't defensive, isn't fearful, but is acknowledging of the inevitability and the natural cycle of life, then we can get over this polarizing of our in-group and our out-group. One of the things that I deal with in my book, Death Makes Life Possible, which will come out in May, is this idea, it's called terror management theory. And it derives from the work of Ernest Becker, who wrote a book called Denial of Death and won a Pulitzer for that book. And that work actually stimulated a whole lot of research in the area of social psychology, where they have been able to document very clearly that if I am not comfortable with or have not consciously acknowledged my own mortality, and then I am triggered somehow, I'm reminded of my own mortality, but not within a space where I feel comfortable, then what happens is I become very protective of my in-group because I feel safe with people whose values are very much like my own. And then I can become very aggressive toward the out-group because they can become demonized in my mind. And I think this phenomenon and the observations that have been done under very carefully controlled, you know, research conditions speaks to the importance of our need as a civilization to redefine our understanding of death and to make peace with our own mortality so that we can live more fully and, you know, die more gracefully. Your question about was there any one tradition, I'm just a big fan of all traditions and really honoring of what I call pluralism. It comes out of the work of Diana Eck. She runs the Pluralism Project at Harvard. But, you know, we know that there's diversity. We know that there are people who have many different, you know, truth claims, worldviews, cultural practices. That's a demographic fact. But pluralism is that acknowledgement and appreciation for our differences in a spirit of celebration. And I think that's kind of my philosophy, is to really celebrate the differences with the idea that there are these common threads that unite us.
Of course, yes, agreed. Do you think the letting go of the fear of death necessitates a knowing of or formulating some kind of opinion about afterlife?
I think it's useful for people to contemplate their own worldview. I think it's helpful. Many people have never thought about it, or if they do think about it, it's come from some reified tradition that, you know, may not be really vital anymore, but has sort of the, you know, old ideas embedded in it. And so it can be frightening for people. So my invitation through the film Death Makes Life Possible, as well as the book and some of the education that we're doing now, is to really help people become aware of and to redefine our relationship to death. And as people think about death and they think about their own worldview about what will happen next, they can begin to breathe into that and they can begin to experience that with a sense of possibility. In the film, you know, we interviewed people from all different traditions, people from an atheist who at the time of the interview was really convinced that there's nothing else. When you're dead, you're done, you're gone, forget it. All the way to, you know, Lauren Artress, who represents the Christian tradition, who had really redefined her understanding of heaven and hell, and not having it be something scary that's going to be, you know, very fearful for us into the future, but really an opportunity for us to live here on this earth with great intention. The Muslim position is very, very interesting from my perspective, where this is considered death, and the after death is considered life, because this mundane experience is temporary, and the afterlife is considered, you know, forever, eternal. I think that's a very different kind of perspective than many people in the Western world are used to thinking about. And my own orientation is, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the Buddhist tradition and the Bardos and the idea that there is some essence of who we are that survives beyond bodily death. And to the extent we can bring our awareness and cultivate our intention to that experience, that at the moment of death we may be able to cross a threshold. You know, all of those are beautiful ways of engaging. And one of the people I interviewed in the film, Rupert Sheldrake, has this idea that perhaps whatever our worldview is what we're going to experience after. And so I think it's important for all of us to think about, to pause, to reflect on, you know, what is my worldview? What is my belief system? And what am I doing to live into the most positive framework I can manifest?
Understood as far as what Rupert Sheldrake is thinking about there. There are so many, you know, the whole DMT thing, for instance, some people are suggesting that that internal production of DMT is what an overdose perhaps is what creates the idea that someone was picked up by an alien. And so the mind, as you know, as an anthropologist, as a scientist, as a healthcare researcher, the mind plays a lot of tricks, for maybe lack of a better word. You know, our beliefs and where our mind goes with things will have an influence on what we're thinking and what we're creating in our lives to an extent, I believe. But what is that extent, and how much can we actually bet on that?
Well, I think that's a big question, and it's an exciting one. It's the opportunity for us to explore our potentials. I don't know that there are firm answers. I think it's really important for people to reflect for themselves on what is true for them. I had the privilege this past week of being with the folks from the Center for Attitudinal Healing. And, you know, their premise is really that whatever we're experiencing, we have the power to influence our own perception. We can see something as an atrocity. We can feel suffering, or we can begin to reframe that. We can reflect on how our minds do play tricks on us. And we do have these powers and potentials within us to begin to transform them. One of the areas that I've done a lot of work on is consciousness transformation. How is it that we change our minds and our behaviors in ways that are more pro-life, pro-social, feelings of goodness toward one another? And in that process, we saw that, you know, there's kind of a change model that we developed out of 20 years of research. And a big factor for people when they begin this process of personal transformation is what we call noetic experiences, these deep first-person encounters with something beyond ourselves. And then, you know, people can either deny that or they can begin to explore it. And in that process, you know, we interviewed 60 masters from different traditions. And what we were able to see is that practice becomes incredibly important, but practice can take many different forms. It can become a formal practice based on, you know, thousands of years of inquiry and repetition, or it can be a newly emerging kind of practice that, you know, we're experiencing now in the 21st century. But we found that there were five qualities to a transformative experience. One is intention. I hold the intention to transform, and in a positive way. But we know the road to hell is paved with good intentions, so intention alone is not enough. And then there's attention. You know, you find these different practices involve helping us to become aware of where are we placing our attention. Is the glass half empty, or is the glass half full? And to the extent we know that it's within our power to define that relationship to the glass, then we can focus our attention in ways that help to serve us. Repetition is another important piece of a transformative practice. Building new habits, knowing that our brains lay down these neural pathways, and that if it's a faulty pathway, then dysfunctional behaviors can continue. But if we can, you know, change those pathways and rewire our habits, we can create new and more sustainable behaviors. The fourth thing is guidance. And the teachers that we interviewed all talked about the importance of finding someone who can help to calibrate the path, who's been there before us. It can be a book. It can be a community. It can be listening to a program like yours where we get that sense of inspiration. But it's also developing the skills to trust our own inner guidance. And what are the truths within us that we know to be inalienable? And finally, the fifth piece of these transformative practices is what I'll call acceptance. That it is really accepting the world for what it is and acknowledging that it is about our own perceptions and that we have a choice in how we perceive the world. So I think all of these factors then influence the qualities of our life and the ways in which we can begin to make progress in, you know, our lived experience.
It seems that everyone, you know, in looking at these mysteries of life, it sometimes seems equally part of the solution and the problem trying to solve or concretize the mysteries of life.
Yeah, I sometimes say that I view science as a spiritual practice. I think it has a lot of qualities that a spiritual practice has, and it is a formal, rigorous way of engaging the mystery. But that doesn't mean we're going to solve everything, and I think there's hubris in the notion that, you know, science is going to complete the story and there will be no questions left.
Right.
There's just so much room for that sense of awe and wonder, and to the extent we can really cultivate that in our lives, I think we can be happier.
Yes, and going back to what you said about creating habits can lead into this, that I read recently something about New Year's resolutions and how everyone makes their goals, but the goals are kind of a dead end because you spend half your time going, oh, I'm not reaching my goal. And then if you do reach your goal, then it's like, oh, you're left hanging all of a sudden. So they were suggesting creating habits because that's an ever moving and evolving situation. And I think it's so important to keep that in mind because, as you just mentioned about science, and nothing is going to give the answer because there is not one simple answer to anything. And in just holding that, science will change constantly, and the fads of consciousness come and go, and healthcare comes and goes. And so holding that awe maybe is the ultimate thing we can do because that just leaves it open.
I think the most important thing for us is to develop the inner capacities that can make us resilient in the face of the outer complexities. So we have, you know, the abilities within us to create these habits that you're describing and to make our agility and our flexibility become the qualities that define any situation that we're confronted with. So if we're rigid and we, you know, have to deal with something that's very hard, you know, the loss of a job, the death of a loved one, a personal illness, if we fight that and resist that, then we suffer. But if, in fact, we can recognize that there are these qualities within us that we can grow and nurture and, you know, breathe life into, then we can become more capable of dealing with those outer circumstances that challenge us, you know, on a daily basis.
Yes, and you're in your world, you are out in this world of promoting and helping people make this transformation and seeing how the world is actually going about this transformation right now. And there's so much talk of the mindfulness revolution that's making changes right now. And I am an optimist to the nth degree. And this makes me think of Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King and the movie Selma and all the black people getting pounded and thrown in jail and everything. And it's I'm just wondering, how are you measuring, so to speak, change? You know, there's obvious numbers, but let's face it, the population is growing. And, you know, you can look at how many white people hate black people or black people that don't like Mexicans, or, you know, it just goes around in a big circle. And so I'm wondering, how do you measure the change?
Well, that's a really complicated question. Thank you for asking. I don't know that there's one simple answer. I think that scientists have, researchers have made attempts to develop instruments that will allow us to look at, you know, within an individual, are they able, through something like a mindfulness practice, to become more resilient, to be less defensive? We can measure changes in the immune system. So is our body healthier when we have figured out ways to manage stress and anxiety? If we can morph stress, we know stress is the big factor. You know, there are a lot of diseases, but the thing that compounds all of it is our response to the stresses in our life. And again, I want to say, I think this is a choice we have. We can build habits that allow us to be resilient in the face of stress, build practices that can allow us to, you know, move more fluidly in life. So I go back to, you know, this terror management theory. And, you know, my goal in this current work that I'm involved in, the Death Makes Life Possible Project, is that we are really initiating a campaign to redefine death. And in that process, to help people think about their own experiences and their own belief systems and their own worldviews, and then to engage in conversation with people who are like us, but people who are not like us. And how is it that we can have authentic, deep conversations in ways that allow us to find our common humanity? And there are many indicators that we're struggling as a civilization, you know, and all we have to do is look at what happened in Paris and, you know, the kind of counter reaction in Germany, where people are, you know, becoming more rigid rather than less rigid about their in-group. I think these things are solvable, you know, maybe not 100%. You're never going to influence all people to want to work together, to want to pull on the same oar. But if you can help to facilitate a kind of paradigm shift within a critical mass of people, that can have very measurable impacts on individual well-being, social well-being, planetary well-being, to the role that our own actions and volition play in either destroying our planet or making it a better place. And so I just want to celebrate what you're doing by offering this kind of conversation. As people are listening, they can find a place within themselves to feel excited.
Marilyn Schlitz's film, Death Makes Life Possible, will show in Boulder January 21st. DeathMakesLifePossible.com is the website. And for any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is at iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.